Welcome to the coronavirus update for Wednesday, October 7th, 2020, from the Recording Library of West Texas. I'm Michael. Here are some of the articles we'll be reading today. Early voting can start October 13th as scheduled, Texas Supreme Court rules. Democratic leaders in Congress urge Governor Greg Abbott to lift limit on mail-in ballot drop-off locations. Essential workers and vulnerable Texans will be the first in line for a coronavirus vaccine, state says. Why doctors aren't so sure Trump is feeling better from COVID-19. U.S. economy is at risk with stimulus still uncertain. How much would Trump's coronavirus treatment cost most Americans? Voters split on Trump's handling of his COVID-19 diagnosis. Trump's COVID-19 treatment hangs over vice presidential debate. Those stories and more are coming up this hour. We'll take a look at the numbers now from the Odessa American. Ector County total cases, both confirmed and probable, 5,122. Ector County negative, 22,820 out of 28,272 tested, with 330 pending, 100 deaths. Recovered, 4,325. Active, 697. ECISD daily cases, 6 students, 2 staff. Midland County, 3,987 confirmed, 85 deaths. From the Texas Tribune. Average new cases increased by 426 cases compared with the 7-day average a week ago in Texas. On October 6th, 3,872 new cases were reported. Hospitalizations increased by 143 patients compared with a week ago. As of October 6th, 3,394 Texans are hospitalized for the coronavirus. Average new deaths decreased by 15 deaths compared with the 7-day average a week ago. On October 6th, 78 new deaths were reported. West Texas Intermediate is trading at $39.51. That's down $1.16. Now here are coronavirus briefs. Rick Wright, a former top government vaccine official, resigned from the National Institutes of Health on Tuesday, several months after lodging a whistleblower complaint. The White House approved tough new standards for coronavirus vaccines on Tuesday after weeks of delay, but only after the FDA unilaterally published the guidelines on its website as part of briefing materials for outside vaccine advisors. Stephen Miller, a senior policy advisor to Trump, is the latest administration official to test positive for the novel coronavirus. More than a dozen people close to the Trump administration or on his reelection campaign have contracted coronavirus in recent days. President Trump continues to recover from coronavirus at the White House. Tonight's vice presidential debate, Mike Pence and Senator Kamala Harris will face off in their only debate of the 2020 cycle. Both candidates have tested negative for COVID-19. Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden said Tuesday that the second presidential debate should not be held if President Donald Trump is still infected with coronavirus, but that he would base his participation in the debate upon recommendations from medical experts. Meanwhile, Senate Republicans plan to press ahead next week with confirmation hearings for Trump Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett. NIH director says he's optimistic a coronavirus vaccine will be proven safe and effective by 2021. Here are some short articles. Eli Lilly seeks authorization of antibody drug for emergency use. Pharmaceutical giant Eli Lilly and Company is seeking emergency use authorization to provide its antibody drug to high-risk patients with mild or moderate cases of COVID-19 in the United States. The Eli Lilly antibody drug is aimed at treating patients who are not yet hospitalized to help prevent severe cases of the disease. It is the same class of medicine as the experimental treatment that was given to President Trump. Trump was treated with an experimental drug made by Regeneron Pharmaceuticals, which is also in discussion with regulators to see if its data merits an emergency use authorization that could make it available outside a clinical trial. The company has not published data yet, but it announced the results of a combination therapy of 2 monoclonal antibodies and a single monoclonal antibody alone. According to the company, the drugs reduced the amount of the virus in people's noses, decreased symptoms, and prevented visits to emergency rooms or hospitals, although there were small numbers of those follow-up medical visits for both patients who received the drug and those who got a placebo. Any treatment to prevent moderate or mild disease from becoming worse could be transformative in the pandemic, but these medications will be in short supply, creating difficult questions about how to prioritize the drug. All U.S. hospitals must now report flu numbers to federal government, HHS says. U.S. hospitals must start reporting flu data to the federal government or face losing federal funding, Health and Human Services Department officials said Tuesday. Hospitals currently report positive and suspected cases of COVID-19, fatalities, and admissions on a daily and weekly basis, and will now be required to report the same numbers for influenza, HHS said. The U.S. could see as many as 400,000 COVID-19 deaths by this winter, Fauci predicts. The United States could see as many as 400,000 deaths from the coronavirus this winter if Americans don't follow public health mitigation guidelines, Dr. Anthony Fauci warned on Tuesday. Fauci had warned in the spring that if the U.S. did not follow the guidance, 200,000 Americans could die from the deadly virus. And sadly, we have 210,000 deaths now, he said during a discussion with American university students. The models tell us that if we don't do the kind of things that we're talking about in the cold of the fall and the winter, we could have from 300,000 to 400,000 deaths. That would be just so tragic if that happens. Fauci encouraged everyone to take simple steps, such as wearing masks, social distancing, frequent hand washing, and doing as much outside instead of inside as possible. The United States' failure to achieve a low baseline level of coronavirus infections over the summer is going to lead into more infections and deaths this fall and winter, Dr. Fauci said. We're stuck at around 40,000 cases a day, Fauci told students. He added that there are parts of the country that are doing well in terms of test positivity rates, but there are also certain areas where you have the uptick in test positivity, which is a very good predictor of a surge in cases, he said. White House email says all contact tracing is complete. The White House told staff in an email on Tuesday that it had completed all contact tracing for positive COVID-19 cases identified at the White House. The email also urged anyone who hasn't been contacted and suspects they have had contact with someone infected to reach out to the White House medical office. Top U.S. military personnel remain in quarantine due to COVID-19 exposure. America's top military personnel are continuing to work from home Wednesday out of an abundance of caution after being exposed to COVID-19. They all remain negative so far, but testing is ongoing, a defense official tells CNN. There is a growing sense that they could remain in quarantine through early next week. CNN reported yesterday that Joint Chiefs Chairman General Mark Milley and several members of the Pentagon's senior leadership are quarantining after a top Coast Guard official tested positive for coronavirus. As President Donald Trump's top military advisor, Milley maintains a full classified communications suite in his house. The Chief of Staff of the U.S. Air Force, Charles Brown, the Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Michael Gidley, and the Chief of Space Operations, General John Raymond, are all working from home, according to several officials. White House Chief of Staff says Trump wanted to go to the Oval Office yesterday. White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows said that Trump is doing real well and said he was briefed by Dr. Sean Conley last night and would be briefed again this morning. During the gaggle, he confirmed reports that Trump wanted to go to the Oval yesterday. Asked if Trump would go today, he said Trump's schedule right now is fluid. We're looking at his prognosis. As he walked away from reporters, Meadows was asked when Trump last tested negative, but did not provide a clear answer, saying he's already answered that question. Trump signals he is itching for a return to the campaign trail. Awaking at home Tuesday after a weekend spent in hospital, President Trump offered no indication his serious bout with coronavirus had changed his perceptions of a disease that has killed more than 210,000 Americans. Instead, Trump signaled he was itching for a return to the campaign trail, even though the virus is ripping through his staff, as he mulled delivering an address to the nation. Restaurants warn of more closures without stimulus. The restaurant industry warns that delaying stimulus, even by several weeks, will cause even more independent restaurants to fail. If Congress and the president walk away from negotiations, even more of our neighborhood restaurants will go out of business, the Independent Restaurant Coalition said in a statement Tuesday in response to President Trump's decision to halt stimulus talks. We cannot afford 5 or 6 more weeks of decreased revenue, more debt, and uncertainty about colder weather, wrote the group, noting that earlier on Tuesday, Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell had underscored the pandemic's disproportionate impact on industries with high in-person contact, like restaurants and bars. The Independent Restaurant Coalition represents 500,000 independent restaurants in the United States, employing more than 11 million restaurant workers. Now here are a few articles I'm going to read portions of from the Texas Tribune. Early voting can start October 13th as scheduled, Texas Supreme Court rules. Early voting in Texas can begin October 13th, following the timeline the governor laid out months ago. The Texas Supreme Court ruled Wednesday, rejecting a request from several top Texas Republicans to limit the time frame for voters to cast their ballots. Abbott added 6 days to the early voting period through an executive order, an exercise of the emergency powers he has leaned into during the virus crisis. The Republicans who sued him argued this was an overreach. Democratic leaders in Congress urge Governor Greg Abbott to lift limit on mail-in ballot drop-off locations. The Democratic chairs of 3 high-profile congressional committees urged Texas Governor Greg Abbott on Tuesday to rescind his order limiting counties to 1 drop-off location each for absentee ballots, saying it appears to be a last-ditch effort to suppress Texans' ability to vote. In a letter to the Texas governor, U.S. House Majority Whip James Clyburn, Democrat South Carolina, and U.S. Representatives Zoe Lofgren, Democrat California, and Carolyn Maloney, Democrat New York, said they are investigating Abbott's order because it may interfere with the administration of free, fair, and safe federal elections in Texas during the coronavirus pandemic. The chairs also asked Abbott to provide documents regarding his decision. Essential workers and vulnerable Texans will be the first in line for a coronavirus vaccine, state says. Texas healthcare workers, unspecified essential workers, Texans who are 65 and older, and those who are at increased risk of illness because of underlying medical conditions will have first access to a coronavirus vaccine once it becomes available, according to the guidelines published Wednesday by the Texas Department of State Health Services. Now we're going to read a few longer articles. This is from the New York Times and turning toward the economy. Pelosi and Mnuchin discuss airline aid as broad stimulus plan is shelved. With stimulus talks appearing dead, discussions for a standalone airline bill are renewed. Speaker Nancy Pelosi of California and Steven Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, spoke Wednesday morning about the prospects of a standalone bill for airline relief as President Trump continued to walk back his own retreat from negotiations on a broader coronavirus relief package and push for more narrow legislation. During the conversation, Mr. Mnuchin asked about the possibility of a standalone bill, as a critical payroll program for airline workers lapsed last week, and airlines have warned tens of thousands of more furloughs and layoffs without federal intervention. Ms. Pelosi noted that Democrats had already thrown their support behind such a measure and reminded Mr. Mnuchin that Republicans had objected to unanimous passage of such a bill in the House on Friday, a spokesman for Ms. Pelosi said. She asked Mr. Mnuchin to review the legislation, championed by Representative Peter DeFazio of Oregon, the chairman of the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee. A Treasury spokeswoman confirmed that the call took place, but would not say what was discussed. Since approving nearly $3 trillion in economic relief this spring, Congress and the White House have failed to reach agreement on another package, despite warnings from economists, including Federal Reserve Chair Jerome H. Powell, that follow-up aid is needed to maintain the country's economic recovery. A long period of unnecessarily slow progress could continue to exacerbate existing disparities in our economy. That would be tragic, especially in light of our country's progress on these issues in the years leading up to the pandemic, Mr. Powell said on Tuesday. Though talks all but collapsed in early August, Ms. Pelosi and Mr. Mnuchin have resumed discussions in recent days as companies continue to furlough or lay off tens of thousands of Americans, and local governments, schools, and industries across the country lobby for more congressional relief. Talks to secure a more comprehensive bill collapsed on Tuesday after Mr. Trump said in a tweet that he had directed his negotiators to stand down on a stimulus bill until after the election. But the president quickly began backtracking on Tuesday night, saying on Twitter that he would sign a standalone bill to send Americans $1,200 stimulus checks. On Wednesday morning, he urged Ms. Pelosi to move fast on the proposal. People close to Mr. Mnuchin said that he was disappointed by the sudden collapse of the negotiations on Tuesday, but that he remained ready to re-engage if given the go-ahead by the president. Mark Meadows, the White House chief of staff, said that he and Mr. Trump spoke to Mr. Mnuchin on Wednesday morning about the possibility of individual bills that could be passed. The secretary and I have been talking about what we could do with standalone bills to help airlines, small businesses, and the American people with stimulus checks. So hopefully we can convince Speaker Pelosi to do something on a standalone basis, Mr. Meadows said on Fox News. It remains unclear whether the House Democrats' airline bill would secure enough Republican support to pass the Senate. Senator Roger Wicker of Mississippi, the chairman of the Senate Commerce Committee, put forward a separate bill for airlines that would have lowered the amount of new money being spent by repurposing some funds from the previous $2.2 trillion stimulus law to help revive the program and keep airline workers employed. U.S. economy without more stimulus is nearing a dangerous tipping point. Here is the situation the U.S. economy faces. With a month to go before Election Day, job growth is stalling, layoffs are mounting, and no more help is coming. American households and businesses have gone 2 months without enhanced unemployment benefits, low-interest loans, and other programs that helped prop up the economy in the spring. And now, after President Trump's announcement Tuesday that he was cutting off stimulus negotiations until after the election, the wait will go on at least another month, and very likely until the next presidential term starts in 2021. It could be a dangerous delay. Already, many furloughs are turning into permanent job losses, and major companies like Disney and Allstate are embarking on new rounds of layoffs. The hotel industry is warning of thousands of closures, and tens of thousands of small businesses are weighing whether to close up shop for good. An estimated one of every seven small businesses in the United States had shut down permanently by the end of August, 850,000 in all, according to data from Womply, a marketing platform. The deeper those wounds, the longer the economy will take to heal. The risk to waiting is that we may find ourselves in a place where we're unable to turn back, will hit a tipping point, said Karen Dinan, a Harvard economist and Treasury Department official during the Obama administration. Jerome Powell, the Federal Reserve Chair, echoed those concerns in a speech Tuesday, arguing that failing to provide enough support carried risks for the economy. Too little support would lead to a weak recovery, creating unnecessary hardship for households and businesses, he said. Over time, household insolvencies and business bankruptcies would rise, harming the productive capacity of the economy and holding back wage growth. The failure to provide that assistance will ripple throughout the economy. The economy needs another round of fiscal support with aid to households, small and mid-sized firms, and states, said R. Glenn Hubbard, a Columbia University economist who was a chairman of the White House Council of Economic Advisers under President George W. Bush. Failing to act will have real economic consequences. Stock indexes, which had risen in recent days on signs that negotiations might be making progress, dropped sharply after Mr. Trump's announcement. Several major Wall Street banks had said in recent days that they would downgrade their growth forecasts if talks stalled. Mr. Trump may have been listening. In a series of tweets late Tuesday, he urged both houses of Congress to immediately revive a lapsed loan program for small businesses and to approve funds for airlines and another round of stimulus checks. It remained unclear if his tweets reflected a willingness to restart negotiations. The gridlock in Washington is a reversal from the spring, when fear of an imminent economic collapse led Congress to vote overwhelmingly to approve trillions of dollars in aid to households and businesses. The effort was largely successful. Households began spending again, companies began bringing back workers, and a predicted tidal wave of evictions and foreclosures mostly failed to materialize. The unemployment rate, which reached nearly 15% in April, fell to 7.9% in September. But most of the aid programs expired over the summer, and in recent weeks, economic gains have faltered. Economists across the ideological spectrum agree that the loss of momentum is likely to get worse if more aid doesn't arrive soon. We had a bridge which took us till about September, and now the question is, do we complete the bridge or don't we? Said Raghuram G. Rahan, a former chief economist of the International Monetary Fund, who is now a professor at the University of Chicago. Without more help, he said, basically anybody who was on that bridge falls off a cliff. Now turning to a different kind of economy, and that's the economics of medicine. Here's another article from the New York Times. How much would Trump's coronavirus treatment cost most Americans? Even those with insurance, surprise bills for things not covered can add up fast. By Sarah Cliff. President Trump spent 3 days in the hospital. He arrived and left by helicopter, and he received multiple coronavirus tests, oxygen, steroids, and an experimental antibody treatment. For someone who isn't president, that would cost more than $100,000 in the American health system. Patients could face significant surprise bills and medical debt even after health insurance paid its share. The biggest financial risks would come not from the hospital stay, but from the services provided elsewhere, including helicopter transit and repeated coronavirus testing. Mr. Trump has praised the high quality of care he received at Walter Reed and has played down the risk of the virus. "Don't be afraid of COVID," Mr. Trump tweeted on Monday before returning to the White House. "Don't let it dominate your life." Across the country, patients have struggled with both the long-term health and financial effects of contracting coronavirus. Nearly 500,000 have been hospitalized. Routine tests can result in thousands of dollars in uncovered charges. Hospitalized patients have received bills upward of $400,000. Mr. Trump did not have to worry about the costs of his care, which are covered by the federal government. Most Americans, including many who carry health coverage, do worry about receiving medical care they cannot afford. For some Americans, the bills could start mounting with frequent tests. Insurers are generally required to pay for those tests when physicians order them, but not when employers do. The Trump administration made that clear in June when it issued guidance stating that insurers do not have to pay for testing conducted to screen for general workplace health and safety. Instead, patients need to pay for that type of testing themselves. Some might be able to get free tests at public sites, and some employers may voluntarily cover the costs. Others could face significant medical debt from tests delivered at hospitals or urgent care centers. COVID tests can be expensive. Although they typically cost $100, one emergency room in Texas has charged as much as $6,408 for a drive-through test. About 2.4% of coronavirus tests billed to insurers leave the patient responsible for some portion of the payment, according to the health data firm Castlight. With 108 million tests performed in the United States, that could amount to millions of tests that leave patients responsible for some share of the cost. Marta Barton, who works as a hair colorist in Brooklyn, needed a coronavirus test to return to her job this summer. She received a $1,394 bill from the hospital running the drive-through site where she was tested. "I was so confused," said Ms. Barton, who is contesting the bill. "You go in to get a COVID test expecting it to be free. What could they possibly charge me $1,400 for? The bills for the typical American would continue at the hospital, with the routine monitoring that any patient would receive and the drugs provided in the course of care. Remdesivir, a new coronavirus treatment created by Gilead, costs $3,120 when purchased by private insurers and $2,340 with public programs like Medicare and Medicaid. Mr. Trump also received an experimental antibody treatment from Regeneron. It's currently available to clinical trial participants or to those granted a compassionate use exemption. In either situation, the drug would typically be provided to the patient at no charge. This would most likely change, however, when the treatment finishes trials and hits the commercial market. These types of drugs are hard to manufacture, and other monoclonal antibodies cost thousands of dollars. Health economists are only starting to understand the full costs of coronavirus treatment, just as scientists are mapping out how the disease works and spreads. They do have some early estimates. The median charge for a coronavirus hospitalization for a patient over 60 is $61,912, according to a claims database, Fair Health. That figure includes any medical care during the hospital stay, such as an emergency room visit that led to admission or drugs provided by the hospital. For insured patients, that price would typically be negotiated lower by their health plan. Fair Health estimates that the median amount paid is $31,575. That amount, like most things in American health care, varies significantly from one patient to another. In the Fair Health data on coronavirus patients over 60, a quarter face charges less than $26,821 for their hospital stay. Another quarter face charges higher than $193,149, in part because of longer stays. Many, but not all, health insurers have said they will not apply co-payments or deductibles to patients' coronavirus hospital stays, which could help shield patients from large bills. Uninsured patients, however, could be stuck with the entire hospital charges and not receive any discounts. While the Trump administration did set up a fund to cover coronavirus testing and treatment costs for the uninsured, The Times has reported that some Americans without health insurance have received large bills for their hospital stays. The biggest billing risk for a patient receiving treatment similar to Mr. Trump's would probably be coming from the helicopter rides to the hospital. Air ambulances are expensive and often not in major health insurance plans' networks. The median charge for an air ambulance is $38,770, according to a study in the journal Health Affairs published this year. When the helicopter trip is out of network, as about three-quarters of them are, patients are left with a median charge of $21,698 after the insurance payout. Taking two hospital rides, as Mr. Trump did, could plausibly result in more than $40,000 in medical debt for patients without access to their own aircraft, though, of course, most people do not leave the hospital by helicopter. The financial consequences of a coronavirus hospitalization could be long-lasting if a new Supreme Court challenge to the Affordable Care Act is successful. That case argues that all of Obamacare is unconstitutional, including the health laws protections for pre-existing conditions. The administration filed a brief in June supporting the challenge. The Supreme Court hears that case on November 10th. If the challenge succeeds, COVID-19 could join a long list of pre-existing conditions that would leave patients facing higher premiums or denials of coverage. In that case, coronavirus survivors could face a future in which their hospital stays increase their health costs for years to come. Now we're going to bring you a few recorded reports. This first one is from NPR. ICU doctor responds to Trump comment, "Don't be afraid of COVID-19.
How does all this look if you're a doctor treating coronavirus patients? Dr. Jamil Mahdi is the chief of critical care medicine at Valley Baptist Medical Center in Harlingen, Texas. In July, he came on this program and described the virus hitting his community like a, quote, tsunami. Now he's back. Dr. Mahdi, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
When you hear the president say to people, don't be afraid of it, don't be afraid of the coronavirus, don't let it dominate your life, what do you think?
Well, the coronavirus is still around. It's still with us. We still are having cases in the hospitals. We are in a much better place right now than we were a few months ago. But we still are getting cases. We still are getting infected people and people being admitted to the hospital. The virus is still here, and it's not going away. And as long as we don't have the exact therapeutics for it, including the vaccines, we need to continue to be vigilant about, you know, doing the right things, including social distancing and hand washing and face masks.
Well, don't be afraid. Sounds like a positive message. You wouldn't want anybody to be afraid. But should we actually be afraid still of the virus, or at least respect it?
We definitely need to respect it. We definitely need to be cautious. I would probably understand where the president is coming from in terms of, you know, portraying an image of resilience and strength after he himself has gone through this. I would also understand, you know, at the same time that although you want to talk about being strong and be moving forward, and we all have to, we cannot keep on, you know, being locked up in our houses and shut down, and I understand that fully. But at the same time, we also have to sympathize with the tragedies that have occurred in the past, including the deaths of over 200,000 people and the people that have been impacted by that. Remember that for every person that has succumbed to the disease, there might be another 50 or 100 people who know that person, who have been traumatized or been affected by the disease. So we're talking about millions of people who have been affected in one way or the other from this disease.
Have you felt over the past several months that the federal government has been getting you the assistance that you need and the public messaging that you need to keep people safe and to treat people?
We have received federal assistance in terms of staffing and nursing and other medical staff into the hospitals, and we are very grateful for what they have done, including the Department of Defense with the Army and Navy. Who have helped us out a lot in the hospitals in terms of when we had the large surge. When it comes to the message about social distancing and masking, it mostly depends on the local communities, the leaders in the communities, to do their jobs in giving out the message and the right message to the people. So it in one community might differ from one another community in terms of what could be the right message by the mayor, by the public health officials. It has to do with these efforts done at the local level.
Meaning that it's up to local officials to deliver credible messaging. Is that what you're telling me, sir?
Correct.
Has there been a lot of confusion about things like whether to wear a mask locally?
There has been. Our local leaders have been strong. Our judges have been strong in terms of conveying the message. They have been on social media, on the news quite frequently to convey the message to the public. And I think the public has done a good job lately compared to initially and early on in the disease or in the pandemic, where there is more public awareness. You see more people wearing masks. You see more social distancing. In terms of restaurants and public places, they are going by the guidelines, and I think that's a good thing. I think that's one of the reasons why the pandemic right now seems to be at a much cooler place than it was a few months ago.
Dr. Mahdi, thank you very much.
I appreciate you.
That's Dr. Jamil Mahdi in Harlingen, Texas.
And now two reports looking at the political side of things. This first is voters split on Trump's handling of his COVID-19 diagnosis. And the next, Trump's COVID-19 treatment hangs over vice presidential debate.
Voters are both denouncing and defending President Trump for how he has handled his own COVID-19 diagnosis, reflecting the deep political divide over how he has managed the pandemic as a whole. As NPR's Tovia Smith reports, even in blue Massachusetts, the president is getting both criticism and kudos.
Tony Boulier never goes anywhere without his Trump hat on the front windshield of his truck and his Trump flag in the back. His mask is usually somewhere on the floor.
I only wear a mask when I got to go in the store or something, but I take zero precautions.
Finishing lunch in his truck outside a sandwich place in Waltham, Massachusetts, Bouliere says Democrats have been exaggerating the threat of COVID just to hurt Trump.
This coronavirus is not going like what they're saying. They make up the numbers.
Bouliere made those comments last week, just before news that the president was infected. Afterwards, he conceded that Trump's diagnosis did make him a little more concerned.
You know, it does make you think a little bit.
Now that the president can get it, so I guess I could get it too.
Yeah, well, I would hate to get COVID and die.
But then, when Trump left the hospital last night imploring voters not to be afraid of COVID, Bouliere's worry waned.
I don't know, maybe it is, you know, not as bad as it cracked up to be.
That's a message Trump is sending. It, COVID, look, I told you, it's nothing. Look, I got over it in 2 days.
Yep, you can too.
This is insanity.
Democrats David Joseph and Dan Forrester, shopping in Waltham yesterday, said they were shocked to see Trump maskless in the White House while contagious, downplaying the dangers of the deadly virus even as cases are rising in many states.
He's throwing gas kerosene on the fire.
It is so disgusting. It's such a slap in the face to the 200,000 Americans who have died.
It sounds like the drugs are impacting his mental acuity, to be honest.
Grad students Alex Berlin and Aislinn Mayfield say Trump is also misleading people since the drugs he's taking are unavailable to other Americans.
For him to kind of just brush it off, you know, he's privileged, but I think he's definitely not thought about a lot of communities of color who need to take it seriously because there's a lot more at risk.
But Trump's supporters brush off the criticism as partisan attacks. No one could have done better against the deadly virus, says Rick Lampron, and Trump is doing his job as a kind of calmer in chief.
He's just trying not to panic people. You have to. Look what happened with the toilet paper.
Another diehard Trumper who asked that his name not be used for fear of being harassed by Trump critics also vehemently defends Trump's weekend drive-by outside the hospital that was widely panned for endangering his Secret Service agents.
These people take a bullet for him. So he has COVID-19 and they're supposed to, what, social distance?
But he and others concede they too bristle at some of Trump's tweets, but they just look the other way. Kevin Mack, a former corrections officer and a former Democrat, says that's because of what he sees as the president's strong leadership on the economy and trade.
The president spews stuff. I ain't saying it's right. But you know what? I just don't want no cupcakes in there. You got to take care of your own country. I mean, we can't be bamboozled.
But polls suggest fewer voters may see it that way, as Trump's handling of his own illness and the pandemic more broadly appears to be eroding public trust in him, leaving more voters wondering if they're being bamboozled by their president. Tovia Smith, NPR News.
And now we're going to bring you an article that we read in the Midland Reporter-Telegram several days ago and haven't had time to run until now. But it is related to some of the stimulus talks that are going on now, especially regarding the airlines. In this piece, the CEO of Southwest Airlines is interviewed, and he is asked where he sees the state of the airline industry right now and where it may go in the future.
Southwest Airlines CEO doesn't expect travel to pick up until 2021. By Kyle Arnold, Dallas Morning News. Going into the office every day, Southwest Airlines CEO Gary Kelly describes the Dallas headquarters atmosphere as feeling a bit like the Mountain Hotel from the 1980s horror flick The Shining. We've got a skeleton staff here, he said. Our headquarters can accommodate about 5,000 people, roughly, and there are maybe 100 people here. Those halls and cubicles are empty for the same reason many airplanes are. The COVID-19 pandemic has changed every aspect of life for the past 6 months. Kelly, who succeeded Southwest founder Herb Keller in 2008, spoke with the Dallas Morning News on Thursday about how the airline, known for its upbeat attitude and friendly service, is handling the toughest financial crisis in aviation history. His answers have been edited for brevity and clarity. How do you see the flying experience now? I've only flown Southwest, and the Southwest experience has been phenomenal. Everybody has to wear a mask, and we don't book the middle seat effectively right now. We've got all our cleaning protocols in place, and the customers are very happy. The feedback that we get from the people that fly is record levels of satisfaction. The operation is running very smooth, very much on time. And it's a pleasure to fly. You can also get a good low fare. We're in the seventh month of the pandemic. how would you describe where the airline industry is today? Oh gosh, the effect has been catastrophic. There's no other way to think about it. It's truly a pandemic in the greatest sense of the word. The effect on travel and tourism and services in general has been catastrophic. I don't think that it's shocking that we are where we are. You go back to the spring, and a lot of it was so new for the United States. People were wondering whether this was going to be more like a seasonal flu. I was reluctant to make any predictions in the spring about what would happen. I'm more of a planner rather than a prognosticator. All we could do is try to establish boundaries for planning, especially when the federal government came through with the CARES Act. It provided us with some breathing room. We made radical adjustments and changes to the airline. We know a lot more 7 months in than we knew 1 week in. I believe we're going to have to muddle through this until we get a vaccine and until we can functionally reach herd immunity. Is it frustrating to watch the pandemic drag on? It's frustrating if one lets himself get frustrated. We don't have time for that. We've got to keep our eye on the ball. We need to run a safe airline. We need to do everything we can to make sure the business survives. I need to do the best job I can to take care of our people and our customers, and we've just got to persevere. We're battle-hardened at Southwest, and we're up to the challenge. I don't see that it serves any purpose to be frustrated with things that are totally outside your control. You and other airline executives had predicted that travel would be down about 30% in the fall. That forecast isn't looking very good right now. I never predicted that. What I was sharing was that that was our guess, that was our plan, knowing we could adjust it if need be. It's easier for us to cut flights than it is to add flights back. But in any event, that's way too optimistic currently because we're down twice that much. What I would predict now is that I don't see that changing significantly from now until we get a vaccine. We will see some lift at that point, and until behaviors change, people are going to have to be confident that we've reached herd immunity. Until we get to that point, I wouldn't expect us to see a significant improvement in traffic. That will be sometime in 2021 at best. Airlines for America's Nicholas Calio said there may not be a full recovery until 2024. Are you looking at the possibility of an extended 3 or 4 year recovery? It's 34 years in the business for me, and it was a long decade after 9/11, and it was a long slog after the Great Recession in 2008. Absolutely, we're prepared for a long recovery. We were very well prepared for the pandemic coming into it with record low levels of debt. We had plenty of cash, and we boosted our cash reserves dramatically this year, and we're working on adjusting our cost structure. We've already got a low-cost structure in the first place and very well suited to serve the leisure side of the market in addition to the business travel market. But I'm certainly not bullish that business travel is going to bounce right back. In fact, I would argue that relative to a normal recession and recovery scenario, this will be twice as long. I wouldn't be surprised to see business travel languish for a decade before it gets back to 2019 levels. So yes, we will be prepared for that. Do you think you'll continue spacing out seating when it's not profitable to do so? I don't think we can do it indefinitely. I agree with that. I think our customers understand that. What we hear from them is that they're very comfortable with what we're doing. Obviously, middle seats are an element of that. Right now, we're interested in learning more about the science of physical distancing on the airplane, given all of the other layers of safety and health protection that are in place. In the end, it's all about what customers are comfortable with. Customers are really happy with the Southwest promise today. I am not really prepared to say when we might change, but at some point, yes, absolutely, we will have to get our business back. It's just going to have to be at the right time. Southwest had 28% of employees take voluntary leave or early retirement. Why do you think that they are so willing to do so when the global economic outlook is uncertain? It's not just one thing that went into people's decisions. It was probably a handful of things, and with some people, maybe more. You have a lot of people that really answered the call. They could do this personally from their own financial perspectives, and they could help out their family members here at Southwest. It was also a reflection of the generosity in terms of the offer. If you were thinking about retiring over the next several years and you had this pretty lucrative offer, for a lot of people it'd be crazy to pass it up. I suspect there were a lot of people who understood this and that it's a really tough time. I'm not sure exactly what kind of effort and sacrifice it's going to take, and I might not be up for that. That's fair, too, because we're going to need all hands on deck to get through this crisis. Our folks are going to have to work really, really hard. I was pleased with that result because it certainly helps us cut our cost down, and we're able to take care of our people and not force any involuntary furloughs. What is the possibility of avoiding furloughs in early 2021 as the pandemic continues? If things don't improve, this just can't continue. We can't lose the kind of cash we lost in the second quarter for quarter upon quarter upon quarter. We'll be out of business. A lot depends on the revenue environment improving. That's front and center of why we are announcing Miami and Palm Springs, because it will help chip away at the revenue deficiency. There are still some levers we can pull, but the vaccine has got to come online and it's got to work. We've got to begin to get back to normal, or else we're just talking about a completely different catastrophic scenario for the airline industry and other industries for that matter as well. Competing airlines are taking a page out of the Southwest playbook by lowering and dropping fees. Does that cut down on Southwest's competitive advantage? The differences between our airlines just shift. I will point out that they're not moving to the Southwest position because most tickets aren't subject to change fees, but with us, it's all tickets. It's somewhat hypocritical of them to claim that this is the right thing to do and then not do it. They have been all about fees and sticking it to customers for a long time. It's not effective now, or they wouldn't be making the change. This just means that now they're going to have to match our fares, and our cost structure is lower and our fares are lower. For them to replace this change fee revenue, they're going to have to raise fares. It's just going to make them try to make a profit and still try to match Southwest fares. That's why they did this in the first place. They needed a gimmick to strip out revenue and reduce their published fare, knowing that they can get money from hidden fees. And now that advantage is being taken away. I think it's better for Southwest, and it's a more level playing field. Are the next 6 months going to be just as damaging as the last six? I think we're past the dark days of March and April, and things have been pretty stable since July 4th. We went into a stall when the COVID-19 cases sharply spiked in early July, which was a shame because we were on a pretty good trajectory. People were feeling more comfortable with travel. The good news is it's pretty stable. Stable's good, but we're at unsustainable levels and it can't go on indefinitely. Beyond the self-help steps taken, what is the government going to do in terms of creating a CARES Act 2? And what will be there in it for continuing the payroll support for airlines? That is a major bearing on our outlook for the next 6 months. Our visibility is not very far into the future. It's pretty easy to predict that we shouldn't expect much improvement in 2020, but I'm still hopeful about the first quarter of next year. We'll continue to press Congress and the administration for CARES 2. I think that would be very helpful to the country, not just the airlines, but to the whole country. We're in a situation that absent some kind of sovereign effort for liquidity, the country goes into depression. No company can be prepared for an almost total loss of revenue and customers. The only way through that is temporary trough is with assistance from the government.
And now here's another piece read also from the Midland Reporter Telegram a few weeks ago from a volunteer. This was a front page story regarding tourism and how the city of Marfa is hanging on in far west Texas.
This article is entitled Marfa Struggles to Strike a Balance Between Tourism and Coronavirus by Alfredo Corchada, Dallas Morning News. Marfa. For much of its history, this town in West Texas has been known as much for its wide-open skies as its big heart. Then, of course, there are those mysterious lights. This year, the famous lights may still shine somewhere off on the majestic horizon, but COVID-19 has forced the town to cancel the annual Marfa Lights Festival held over the Labor Day weekend, which usually features food trucks, live music, and plenty of dancing. Two of Marfa's favorite sons, Tim Johnson and Primo Carrasco, lamented the news during their weekly Dos Horas regional Noteño music program last week on Marfa Public Radio. They also reminded listeners not to forget to take COVID-19 precautions. This will be a sad time here in Marfita, Carrasco said in Spanish, adding that this year there will be no music. We won't have anything, but we wish you nothing but the best this Labor Day. Wash your manitas, hands, keep your distance, and wear a face mask. Johnson added, we all look forward to a time when we can all be together and celebrate Marfa Lights. Marfa, a town of about 1,800 people, takes its many celebrations to heart. It's been that way for generations. But this small, mostly Mexican-American town turned arts hub couldn't escape the impact of the pandemic, which has devastated entire economies and lives worldwide. The pandemic puts the striking region in a quandary. Nestled on a high plateau in the northern Chihuahuan Desert, Marfa is surrounded by gems that lure tourists from everywhere. Big Bend National Park is to the southeast, and to the north lies the McDonald Observatory, which, until the pandemic, would host stargazing parties. In between are striking, quirky communities, from Presidio on the border to Ojinaga, Alpine, Marathon, and Fort Davis, all under skies that take the breath and worries away. But the visitors that are the source of local livelihoods also threaten a spike in COVID-19 cases. So far, Marfa, which lies in Presidio County, hasn't recorded any COVID-19 deaths within the county, although at least three people have died in the closest hospitals, some 3 hours away in El Paso and Midland Odessa. Presidio County has reported about 80 coronavirus cases since March, said David Beebe, justice of the peace for Precinct 1, but the lack of medical care puts the region in a vulnerable position. Locals walk a fine line between welcoming to visitors and worrying about them spreading the deadly infection, he said. So we're not saying stay away from here, this is our place, not yours, Beebe said. That's not who we are or what we want to do. But the healthier we stay, the more we'll be able to continue to welcome everybody, because we want to continue sharing the beauty of solitude, where skies are really big and the sound of trains are beautiful. Others aren't so thrilled about welcoming visitors during a pandemic. Last spring, native son Daniel O. Hernandez, a state legislative assistant for Texas Democratic Senator Jose Rodriguez, penned an open letter to the Houston Chronicle titled, Stay Home, Marfa's Closed. Rodriguez took issue with the Chronicle's Where to Go glamping across Texas. Especially offensive to some locals was the opening line, Self-quarantine? No problem. Texas has its share of upscale, high-end hotels and opulent, sprawling ranches. Hernandez suggested visitors can support Marfa by going online and buying gift certificates or merchandise, or just being extra careful about not spreading the virus. It's easy for others to talk about opulence and affluence when they're hundreds of miles away from here, but you know what? My dad and brother work in hospital quality. My mom is a food service director of the school, he said. Rodriguez reminds visitors that essential workers are mostly local Mexican-Americans or Mexicans from nearby Ojinaga. They, along with communities of color, represent the most vulnerable population that's succumbing to the virus in Texas and beyond. Marfa, in some sense, is very affluent and does very well in terms of attracting high-end tourists who like to spend money, stay in nice hotels, he said. But at the end of the day, it is still Latinos who are the ones that are the cooks and the servers and the dishwashers and the hotel clerks and the housekeepers who are keeping the town going. They are the central essential workers, and we need to take care of them. Walking that fine line has been difficult. Tourism and livelihood go hand in hand. The economic consequences have been especially devastating. For now, the streets are mostly empty. Many businesses remain closed, and it's not entirely clear whether they'll reopen. Others show signs of life. Marfa is still open, and we're glad to have folks here, said Emily Williams, general manager at the Hotel St. George. We're glad to have folks at the hotel, dining with us, or at the pool. Across Marfa, I think everyone just appreciates all of our guests remembering that it's people's home, too. Marfa is not just to get away. While a lot of people depend on visitors, we're depending on you to keep it safe and healthy. Labor Day weekend is particularly meaningful here. The Marfa Lights Festival is the main attraction, featuring that strange phenomenon of yellowish orbs spotted hovering in the sky. People park along roadsides in lawn chairs and stare out at the wide open skies, their eyes trained on the area. For locals, the Marfa Lights Festival also is a homecoming weekend of sorts, beckoning former residents to spend time with their families. They flock to the historic Presidio County Courthouse with its pink stucco and luscious green lawn. The event marks the unofficial end of summer and ushers in autumn and a host of events. The biggest is the Chinati Foundation's annual weekend event, where all of artist Donald Judd's installations open for self-guided viewing, and the museum presents special exhibitions, talks, and performances, all free to the public, according to its official website. This year's event, set for October 10th to 11th, will be virtual. The two festivals are a fusion of Marfa's local and newcomers, a mixture of folklore and fine arts. Marfa, some say, has been humbled by the pandemic as local residents rely more on each other than tourists or transplants, many of whom are easily spotted, sporting brand new jeans and new cowboy boots and 10-gallon hats. We're finding our way through this little by little, returning to our roots, our own character, because we're mostly alone, sadly without many visitors, said Ramona Tejada, cook at one of the town's most beloved institutions, Marfa Burrito. Her wall of fame includes pictures of celebrities from Matthew McConaughey to Mark Ruffalo. It's up to us to push our community forward. In addition to his radio show, Johnson is a longtime resident and organizer of events, including the Agave Marfa Festival Marfa and Desert Encrypts, both of them canceled. He's also owner of Marfa Book Company and Gallery, where business is down by about 85%, he said. Still, amid the turbulent times, Johnson sees a silver lining, a moment to debate, if not reclaim, Marfa's identity, an identity that at times seems to stray too far toward the hipster, glamorous, overly high-priced way. The pandemic has given us an opportunity, I think, to hopefully reground ourselves in our relationship with our community. How do we keep true to who we are without living up to the image which we find in the New York Times, which we've always felt was a little bit, always somewhat inaccurate? At some point, he said, our image kind of got a little bit away from us.
And in relation to that story, here's another pre-recorded report, this one also about the area in far west Texas. From Marfa Public Radio, here's a story that they did about tourism in the area right now.
The pandemic has taken a major toll on the tourism economy in west Texas. The region is home, of course, to Big Bend National Park, as well as several popular state parks. But many of the area's attractions, like museums and businesses, have limited their hours or closed altogether. In our series Tipping Point, we explore tourism-driven development in Marfa and the greater Big Bend region. But with little to no tourism, what lies ahead? Reporter Carlos Morales takes it from here.
The noonday sun in Terlingua, Texas is blindingly hot. Crystal Albright takes me into one of the few shaded areas within eyeshot of this far-flung corner of the Chihuahuan Desert.
And then we're coming up on the boat barn.
Albright is a co-owner of Desert Sports. The company runs guided tours. Bikes and kayaks and canoes are stacked up to the ceiling. She pats her boats as she calls out their names.
This is Sierra. And Sierra is named after one of our guide's dogs. And then there's one that's Rubia. She was a blonde German shepherd that showed up here one day. And
the boats aren't getting much use these days. Tourism here always slows in the summer. But this March, hotels, motels, and short-term rentals closed for more than a month to everyone but essential workers. And the region's biggest tourist draw, the 800,000-acre Big Bend National Park, closed and then reopened with limited access.
We had been through other closures before. There had been a couple of government shutdowns. We're used to having those challenges thrown at us, but this one was a little different.
By all accounts, Far West Texas was on track to have a banner year. The national park was expected to surpass 500,000 visitors for the first time in its 76-year history. And when tourism is high, the dollars to nearby cities follows.
The visitation went from full steam 100% to zero.
Robert Alvarez is the executive director of the local tourism board, Visit Big Bend.
We didn't think it would be to this extent or last this